Hello, my name is Brian Novoselsky, and welcome to the Over the Counter podcast. Today, we are joined by Jeff Goad, president of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Great, thank you.
So today, we're going to be discussing current developments regarding hepatitis vaccines in honor of Viral Hepatitis Awareness Month, celebrated throughout the month of May. So Jeff, can you start by briefly explaining what hepatitis is and how it impacts patients' health?
Sure, absolutely. So as the name implies, hepatitis is really just an inflammation of the liver. It's actually most often caused by viral infections, such as Hep A, B, and C, and we'll talk a bit more about those. But it can also result from alcohol use and abuse, toxins, autoimmune disorders, and some other things that may also lead to liver damage. And really the impact of this has to do when we think about chronic disease with hepatitis, like hepatitis B and C, is the nature of it leading to things like cirrhosis, liver failure, and even liver cancer. Hepatitis A, on the other hand, is mostly an acute infection, and it can lead to something like flu-like symptoms, jaundice and fatigue, but in severe cases can result in liver failure. But unlike hepatitis B, it doesn't have a chronic phase. And of course, both Hep A and B have at the core of prevention vaccines available.
Awesome. Cool. So got a basis of kind of what hepatitis is before we really dive into the ins and outs of vaccines. So can you now summarize what hepatitis diseases exist and which vaccines are currently approved in the U.S. to protect patients from these diseases?
Sure. Well, I think first we start with hepatitis, the viruses themselves, which are interesting in that the only thing they really have in common is that they affect the liver. Otherwise, the viruses are actually very different that cause hepatitis. So we have basically five main types of hepatitis that affect humans. That's Hep A, B, C, D, and E. So we'll take each of them, but really kind of focus more on Hep A and B that we could actually do something about. And when I said they're different, they differ even in the type of vaccine from the genetic level. For example, hepatitis A is an RNA virus. As I said before, it causes acute liver infection, but it's spread by the fecal-oral route. So mainly you get this from contaminated food and water. And of course, it is vaccine preventable. Whereas hepatitis B is actually a DNA virus, and it's transmitted differently than Hep A. It's bloodborne, it's sexually transmitted through injection drug use, and even perinatally from mother to child. And of course, this one, like Hep A, is also vaccine preventable. And then that gets us into the rest of them that are not vaccine preventable, such as hepatitis C, that a while back used to be called non-A, non-B, now named as hepatitis C. It also causes a chronic liver infection, just like hepatitis B, but no vaccine available. And then hepatitis D, interestingly enough, only affects individuals who have hepatitis B. So kind of a strategy to protect or prevent against hepatitis D is to get vaccinated against hepatitis B. And then last is Hep E, which is transmitted more similarly to hepatitis A through contaminated water, but fortunately it's very rare in the United States. And then that leads us then to, well, what vaccines are available to actually prevent these types of hepatitis? So on the inactivated side, all of our vaccines that we use for Hep A and B are inactivated. They're all made a little differently, but it's important to note there are no live vaccines in the hepatitis A and B area. So from a vaccine availability for Hep A, we actually have two vaccines and a combination vaccine. So we have Havrix and Vacta, which are two hepatitis A vaccines. They're interchangeable, according to the CDC, both over 95% protective after two doses, and immunity easily lasts more than 20 years. Now, we also have a combination vaccine of hepatitis A and B called Twinrix, approved only for adults. But interestingly enough, it has the hepatitis A component in Twinrix is actually pediatric strength, meaning that you have to give three doses of the Twinrix to be equivalent to two doses of adult hepatitis A. So if you are going to use the Twinrix vaccine, you do need to complete the series. Now, for the hepatitis B vaccines, we have three vaccines available. two of the more older ones, which are the recombinant-based vaccines, such as Engerix-B and Recombivax. But we also have a newer one called Heplisav-B. And then, of course, we still have the combination vaccine, Twinrix, which does have full-strength recombinant vaccine for type B in it. Now, the effectiveness of all these vaccines are easily over 95%, and immunity lasts for decades. So both the Hep A and B give very long-lasting immunity. They do differ on their schedules. So, for example, the recombinant vaccines, Engerix and Recombivax, need to have three doses, and you can start them at birth. Remember, this is the only vaccine that's available to be given at birth, is the hepatitis B. Now, the Heplisav B, however, is approved for adults, so 18 and over, and it's a two-dose series, so you only have to use two versus three doses, but it is focused on the adult population. Right? And then, of course, you know, how do we decide who gets these vaccines? A lot of them are based on categories such as behaviors, right? For example, what you eat, or we've seen outbreaks of Hep A in homeless populations. So there are some social behavioral aspects, sexually transmitted diseases, again, under behavioral. And then, of course, there's where you live and work. Healthcare workers, for example, are at risk for hepatitis B, but not Hep A vaccine. And we want to make sure that they get vaccinated. And then, of course, travel risk for both Hep A and B. But most people think of Hep A when they think of travel to endemic regions, which mostly is the entire world, minus a few developed countries. And then, of course, medical risks. So people who already have chronic liver disease should be vaccinated against Hep A and B as well. And then lastly, some post-exposure. So, for example, if you got the bad raspberries from, you know, an outbreak from a grocery store, you might be advised to get Hep A vaccine. It does work post-exposure, as well as Hep B for post-high-risk exposures as well. So there are several reasons why you might use the vaccine, and we can maybe get into some of those, especially in those over 60, where the universal recommendation for hepatitis B ends. So remember, for vaccination strategies, our Hep A, we give it to all of our kids starting at 1 year of age, and then we catch up adults. For Hep B, as I mentioned before, we started at birth, but we can also catch that up all the way through childhood through 19, right? So 18-year-olds are considered children by the CDC, so that's why it's on that table. But now we also have universal guidelines, recommendations to use the Hep B vaccine all the way to 59. You might wonder why over 60. It's a risk-benefit calculation the CDC did, but there are some individuals over 60. For example, those who are maybe going to have new sexual partners, increasing the risk of sexually transmitted infection. Those with diabetes actually are a greater risk, and that's mostly came out of studies looking at sharing of Lancet devices to test for blood glucose. And of course, if you're a healthcare worker over 60, you got a new job, you might need to get the hepatitis B vaccine, and residents in long-term care facilities might be at greater risk. Again, that goes back to the diabetes risk around diabetes and blood glucose testing. So that's sort of a little explanation of the vaccines that we have available to prevent hepatitis A and B.
Great. Yeah, that was a great overview of kind of the well-established immunization schedules that we do have for hepatitis A and B. So sticking with vaccines, and kind of one of the more notable issues within vaccine administration is vaccine hesitancy. So vaccine hesitancy seems to be a growing concern in the U.S., with the dissemination of misinformation on social media and beyond. Are there certain trends in vaccine hesitancy regarding Hep A and Hep B vaccines particularly?
Yeah, I think maybe now more than ever, we're paying a lot more attention to what people think about vaccines, both from what we call the misinformation, meaning that they just got the wrong information, probably from the wrong source, or disinformation, which is a little bit more scary, that's intentionally spreading wrong information. So we're very sensitive to that. And a lot of the myths around vaccination apply to Hep A and B, but there are some maybe specific trends around what people think about Hep A and B. For example, perceived risk. Most people think that you only get hepatitis A if you travel, for example. But we know that hepatitis A, we've had large outbreaks, for example, in California and a few other states related to the homeless population. We also get outbreaks from restaurants within the United States and grocery stores with certain types of foods that are pre-prepared and then distributed through grocery outlets. And the CDC monitors these very closely through their food safety program. We also know that there are low vaccination rates, right? So low vaccination rates also tend to tell us a little bit about what people think about these Hep A and B vaccines. For example, Hep A in the adult population. Remember, there is no universal recommendation for Hep A in the adult population. That's for pediatrics. So it's probably not surprising that we only have about a 9% vaccination rate for Hep A in adults. But for kids, we're running at about 83% after two doses. So we'd like to see the 83% over 90, which is what we see for most pediatric vaccines. So we have a little bit of ways to go for the pediatric side, probably a long ways to go for the adult. And in the hepatitis B area, we see about 30 to 50% vaccination. And again, for adults, that's really probably focused more on high-risk population. Those, for example, who have renal disease or liver disease, in those populations, we're still not capturing all of them. But in the general population, we're probably a lot lower. For kids, we're over 90% for a full dose series. So we're where we should be. We could be a little higher, but 90% is pretty good for hepatitis B in kids. And then, of course, there's just a general mistrust in vaccines. And again, that misinformation versus disinformation is important. Some of the more specific ones around Hep A, again, as I mentioned, vaccines are necessary unless you're traveling, but keep in mind there is domestic use for the vaccine. And hepatitis A doesn't cause serious illness. Most people, when they hear about it, they hear about it as maybe causing some flu-like symptoms, but we do know it can lead to acute liver injury and liver failure in some people. And of course, Hep A has harmful additives. We've heard this for many vaccines. For example, there's no mercury, there's no thimerosal. Thimerosal is a source of mercury. There is none in any of the Hep A or B vaccines. For Hep B, right, for example, vaccines are only needed for healthcare workers or drug users. And it turns out people who have sex are at risk for hepatitis B. And in developing countries, we really see that maternal transmission, which we may not think about here in the United States because we screen our mothers, but realize people immigrate to the United States and may bring hepatitis B with them in a chronic phase that maybe they acquired from their mother. And then, of course, the old myth, natural immunity is better than vaccination, right? Of course, if you're to get the actual infection, it could lead to liver failure. And in hepatitis B, liver cancer. So again, remember, hepatitis B was our first cancer vaccine. It actually prevents cancer. So when you're thinking about positive messages to counter some of the myths around it, most everyone can get around prevention of cancer. So that might be something to make sure you talk about. You know, as pharmacists kind of plan their strategies, making sure that they're making evidence-based recommendations and really talking about hepatitis B from the facts, referencing credible sources. The CDC hopefully remains a credible source as we go forward over the next few years, but we also have non-governmental organizations like the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases at nfid.org that also has a lot of information for consumers and healthcare providers. But thinking about, you know, how do we normalize some of this? We have to talk to your patients. So that's offering vaccines, for example, at every pharmacy visit, reducing some of those access barriers since we know that most of the population walks through the doors of a pharmacy every week. We could actually increase adult coverage just by putting that little reminder into every time that you interact with patients. So there are a lot of strategies that we can employ to help combat some of the myths and misinformation around vaccines, and particularly Hep A and B.
Awesome, yeah. So I think that's a good segue. I'm going to get into kind of a specific situation pharmacists may kind of encounter on a day-to-day. So what would your advice be for a patient who may not have concerns in seeking the hepatitis A or B vaccine for maybe themselves or for their child, or patients that may prioritize other immunization regimens before the hepatitis vaccine? How would you kind of help patients get a basis on that?
Well, I think people always do that risk-based calculation, that economic calculation. And all we can do is really help them through understanding the risks and benefits of vaccine. So on the benefit side, for example, we know the hepatitis vaccines, they're safe. They've been used for decades. They're effective, over 95% effective, and they're long-lasting. For decades, we've known that these vaccines continue to work even after vaccination in childhood. So we have really, really reliable vaccines that prevent things like cancer, which we have to keep reminding patients. We know that there are continual hepatitis A outbreaks in the United States. You probably hear about them on the local level. We don't see as many national outbreaks, but there have been some very notable ones. But within your states, you're going to hear about the restaurant down the street, the grocery store, and you're going to hear about hepatitis A in those. As we source foods from other countries, which very likely we'll need to continue to do, that's when we bring in the risk of hepatitis A outbreaks. And of course, hepatitis B silent progression. It has a very, very long incubation period, up to 6 months, which means you can be asymptomatic and transmitting the disease, making it very important as a strategy to think about how do we help people understand that this disease causes cancer, right, liver cancer, and it's highly effective, but you may not know you're even being exposed to it. So this is a really good reason to get a vaccine when you could be exposed through sexual contact or blood and you don't know about it. And of course, hepatitis A vaccines, like all vaccines, can be co-administered. So if they're worried about getting too many vaccines, maybe they can get the hep A and B at the same time. Of course they can. But if they want to reduce the number of shots, they can consider the combination vaccine of hep A and B. And then of course, thinking about how does moving to universal recommendations, that's new for hep B. And it's a strategy we used for influenza. If those of you remember, influenza used to have a lot of different high-risk populations that you had to think about. And eventually we got to everyone 6 months and older, right? For hepatitis B, we're on the pathway to that. We now have it all the way from birth through 59 years of age for universal recommendations. What universal means is you don't need a condition. You don't need a certain occupation. You just should get the hepatitis B vaccine. And then over 6 days, as I discussed, there are some high-risk conditions that you may still consider through shared clinical decision-making initiating the hepatitis B vaccine if they have not already had it.
Awesome. Yeah, I think this has been a great overview of both vaccines and kind of everything that patients should know and pharmacists should know. Finally, I kind of wanted to focus in on pharmacists. And do you have a kind of examples? You kind of touched on a little bit about what pharmacists can be doing, but how have they helped bolster vaccine uptake for hepatitis? Maybe you've seen real world evidence of pharmacists spreading awareness, providing increased immunization efforts, or are there any other notable initiatives pharmacists kind of have undertaken for hepatitis vaccines?
Sure. I mean, I think by first highlighting the gap in immunization, as I mentioned before, hep A vaccine for adults is probably under 10% in most places. For hep B, it's under 50%. So we have a long way to go to get the population vaccinated. So there's a need for other vaccine providers, such as pharmacists in this area. And maybe where we've seen some of the initiatives are more specific to pharmacy services. For example, there's evidence that extending hours, offering walk-in vaccinations, and in states that require protocols, having protocols that are easy to understand and easily to implement, in some studies have shown a 30% or greater uptake of vaccinations. So there's some data that shows that just offering the vaccines and having it available at times that maybe clinics don't have it available increases vaccination. We have some very specific examples around outbreaks. For example, in California, when over 1,000 of our homeless population was infected, pharmacists stepped up and gave over 100,000 vaccines, right, in over the year's time period to really protect the environment, the community in Los Angeles, which is where the outbreak took place. But we've also seen outbreaks in Michigan and Kentucky. So it's not just on one side of the country or the other, it's throughout. And pharmacists have been participating, especially in those outbreak situations. And then lastly, there's a lot of evidence around mobile clinics. We learned a lot during COVID that you can bring vaccine to people, and that also increases the rate of vaccination. So we've seen outreach programs where, for example, in California, we had programs where we're doing both screening and outreach. We do mostly screening for hepatitis B in immigrant populations, but really for everyone else, we don't need to screen, we just vaccinate. So outreach programs, mobile clinics, getting into the field and really helping out, especially in the unhoused population, is a great place to do mobile clinics. So I think, you know, really some strategies for us moving forward, thinking about how we can promote hepatitis B universal recommendations now for 19 to 59, making sure that pharmacists integrate that step where they asked patients about their vaccine history as a routine part of the pharmacy experience. We ask about allergies, ask about vaccinations, and really hit head on those myths, the disinformation and misinformation around vaccination. Have flyers up. We've seen lots of examples of having posters and flyers to help debunk some of these myths. If anything, they're a conversation starter for our patients. So we want to kind of finish by really kind of saying that pharmacists are uniquely positioned in the community. They're a trusted source of information for decades now. We need to make sure to leverage our trust using the real information, the authentic information that people have come to know and trust, such as CDC, and of course with our NFID, that are available for our patients and for providers to make sure that we're getting people the right information so that they can make the right decision.
Awesome. Well, I think that was the perfect way to conclude this discussion. Like you said, the numbers are still somewhat lacking. So strategies, whether big or small, that hopefully they can help, and hopefully we can see them kind of in action throughout these next couple years or so. So I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Great.
Thank you.